And you hated all things Vietnam, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I felt it. I felt it all the time. These were the people that had killed my father. I grew up thinking, yeah, well, they experienced loss too, but they didn't really have any feelings, did they?
I want to do everything I can to get him found and to bring him back. I want that done in my lifetime.
December 7th, 1966, Air Force Captain John Werner Carlson of Chicago, age 27, went down near Benoit in his single-seat F-5 jet fighter. He left behind a young wife and two little girls who have struggled mightily over the years to understand the depth of their loss and how to reckon with a deep anger for an enemy far away. 57 years after he went down, Captain Carlson remains listed as missing in action. His daughters, Margot Carlson Delonia and Kim Carlson Benner, are determined to change that, piecing together every bit of information they can muster to find their father's crash site. But there's much more here than one family's quest for closure. Two sisters over the years have vanquished their hatred with an understanding that war does not direct its pain exclusively to one side. In 2015, Margot founded what's called the Two Sides Project. Its aim is to connect sons and daughters, Americans and Vietnamese, who lost their fathers in the war. Those in-person connections have given birth to some profound healing. Margot and I sat down in February to discuss her family's journey and the Two Sides Project. Her sister Kim joined us from Boston.
Hi.
Good morning, Kim. How's the weather in your neck of the woods?
The weather is February cold.
That's all right.
With a teeny bit of snow, but it's okay.
Well, it's February warm where Margot and I are, so.
Sorry.
All right, that's no problem.
Lucky.
I want to rewind the clock for you two and go back a good many years. You were four, Kim, when your father was lost, and Margot, you were two. And I don't suspect any two-year-old has any kind of recollection of Dad.
Nope, none. No recollection. But Kim, I think you have one memory of him.
I do. I have one vivid memory, and it actually must have happened when I was two, because I remember a conversation with my dad, and we were going to a parade, and he said, "We're going to a parade. You are 2 years old, and I had too many Lorna Doones."
That's a lasting memory.
Ever since then, I've never forgot the spelling difference between two and two.
Good for you.
Yeah, but that's really the only memory I have.
Do the two of you remember when you fully realized that you would not be seeing your father again?
I do. I remember a moment where my mother came into our bedroom and she had, you know, a flag on her lap and she said, "Your dad's not coming back." And I don't know if that fully registered at that moment. I think probably given where we were, I was six or seven maybe when she said that, but... Yeah, I distinctly remember that.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Kim, I don't know if you remember that or you have other memories of when you realized.
I feel like I remembered, I remember walking in some pine forest with Mom, and it had to be in South Carolina, so it had to be pretty close after he died. I don't remember the exact conversation, but I think just knowing that things were going to be very different forever. Mm.
Do you think about how difficult that was for your mom to break that news to you and trying to judge from a tender age for you two? How do you tell your kids that?
Oh, I can't even imagine. I don't have children. Kim does. I cannot imagine how horrible and challenging and lonely that must have been for her. And it's just so difficult. I appreciate that today, not even having kids. But Kim, you with children, you probably have a different perspective on that entirely.
I honestly, until Paul just asked me that question, I've never thought of it. Hmm. I really? Never thought of how hard it must have been for her to do that. I think that I feel like I remember people treating us differently after. And I didn't like people feeling sorry for us. And it felt like we were different now.
And I know you've written, Kim, that you felt vulnerable growing up.
Yes.
Vulnerable in what respect?
I think I was always scared somebody was going to hurt me. I didn't feel like I had somebody who was going to take care of me and make sure I was going to be safe. I remember thinking at an early age that it was going to have to be me, and that was frightening.
Well, growing up without a parent is hard enough, but when you've lost that parent in wartime, there are lots of different layers that are piled on, and you don't have any closure because your
right.
dad then, as now, is still missing in action. So there's
right.
no and, end to this.
And it's also not something that we talked about.
Nobody talked about it back then, did
right.
they?
Right.
No.
And, you know, arguably our mother was missing too. I mean, what an incredible shock for her. You know, they, of course, had a plan that if something happened to him, she was to go to graduate school, get a degree in library science, and become a librarian, which was an option for women in that day. And that's what she did. But she was very absent. You know, she was very absent. She was grieving. And she was grieving in the midst of this huge uproar about the war itself. And, you know, to some degree, having to hide her relationship to it. In the end, of course, she came out as a vocal opponent of it and spoke publicly about that. But we missed our mom too, honestly.
Yeah.
So we were alone. We were very alone.
And the two of you then spent a lot of time at Grandma and Grandpa's house in Park Ridge.
Mm.
That's where you spent summers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Kim, I have great memories of that. You probably do too. But Grandma and Grandpa were just wonderful, warm people. It was so lovely to be in the town where my dad grew up. Our dad grew up in Park Ridge, Illinois. I have just a lot of memories of Grandma cooking for us and our grandfather tending the roses in the backyard and watching Cubs games down in the... and swearing. Watching Cubs games and swearing a lot from the basement. So, Kim, what do you remember?
Well, we had a lot of cousins in the area, mm-hmm. so we got to spend a lot of time with family, which is not something we were able to do when we were in New Jersey.
Yep.
So, I mean, we were gone for like 8 weeks and Grandma took such good care of us, and we just knew how much she loved having us there.
Now, Kim, you said you felt vulnerable. Margot, how did the loss of your father manifest itself in you? You had some real difficulty over the years.
I did. I think I just felt abandoned, and I was really concerned about being rejected by other people or abandoned by other people. And so I was constantly kind of on the lookout for, you know, what can I do better? What can I do right? How can I make people love me? You know, really, that was my quest. And when I was 12, I had my first drink of alcohol, and that was the magic potion that I had always been looking for. It made me feel like I could fit in and that I was loved and I was okay. And so that kicked off a dependency on alcohol and drugs for 10 years before I got sober. So I did have a rough time. I was in and out of trouble at schools. I changed schools a lot, you know. Kim was always I don't want to call you the good kid, Kim, but you were such a good student and a stable person. I was pretty unstable, so.
Well, what brought you out of that?
Thank God actually my grandmother, my dad's mom introduced me to a 12-step program. She had some experience with alcoholism. Her stepmom had been an alcoholic. She knew exactly where to get help. She made me go to a meeting when I was actually 15 years old.
Did you resist?
Absolutely. I was way too young. I was having too much fun. But at that time, you know, 3 years into my drinking career, I was a full-blown alcoholic. And I was living with my grandparents at the time. And fortunately, that was just a great experience. And so she was the one who introduced me to that program, but it wasn't another six or seven years later until I actually got sober. I will be forever grateful to her for that introduction to that way of life because it's guided me ever since.
Well, the hate kind of the hate that you felt in your heart. I mean, you hated all things Vietnam, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I, you know, it wasn't this murderous sort of rage that maybe, you know, you hear about or read about. It was more like this undercurrent of active hostility and yeah, hatred, which is almost, I think, more destructive to people. You know, I don't have to be a murderous person to have this sort of hatred. And yeah, I felt it all the time. These were the people that had killed my father. I grew up thinking, yeah, well, they experienced loss too, but they didn't really have any feelings, did they? You know, they didn't really feel as deeply as I did about that loss. And, you know, just almost dehumanizing them. And so it was always this us versus them. That was the place where my dad died. Those are the people who killed my father. I will never set foot in that country. Never. Mm-hmm. And that's how I grew up thinking.
Kim, did you feel similarly?
I felt, well, in terms of Margo and I had different reactions. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky that I was surrounded by good mentors, strong adults, very good friends, and I didn't want to mess that up by breaking any of the rules. I didn't know what would happen to me if I got kicked out of school. So I did whatever I needed to do to be considered a good student and somebody worthy of a scholarship. I was very active in sports. I was good in academics. I was, you know, just happy and popular and trying to fit in.
Okay. Well, I was struck, Margo, by one thing that you said. I really hope for healing because I don't think you can hate for that long.
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful.
It is. I think as you mature, you start to see these things that have impacted your life all along, and there are things that you want to keep and things you want to discard. And the hatred was one thing I just thought, you know, I had gotten sober. I'd been sober for decades. And honestly, I didn't have much of this thought until much later on that, you know, if I continue to hate this group of people and resent this war and resent what happened to me in my life, I will drink again. Like, this is serious stuff. I got to let this go. And so that, you know, thankfully, turned into a thought of, well, you know, there was another side of this war and I wonder what those people are like. And, you know, just a natural sort of curiosity as you let that stuff go of who is this other side and what are they doing and how do they explain the war and what are they thinking and feeling? And I just really got curious.
So thus is born the Two Sides Project.
Yes, and that was back in 2015. And
but it wasn't an epiphany, right? It came about through a period of time.
It was a combination of both. This kind of sense that I had to get rid of this resentment or I was going to drink again really terrified me, you know. And but I also, you know, as the 40th anniversary of the end of the war approached, and in 2015, my mother actually and I had been talking, and she had been interviewed for an article about that and her feelings about the war and everything. And I said to her, you know, I'm interested in meeting other Vietnamese sons and daughters who lost fathers on the opposite side. How can I do this? And she says, well, I think I know somebody you can reach out to. And it was the writer of that article who had interviewed her. I reached out to him. He was very well connected with government officials back in Vietnam. And I talked to him. He said, listen, I think you should send me a 2-page write-up and tell me what you want to do, and I'll forward it to the people I know. And so I spent a whole weekend sort of working on this and naming it and working with my husband a little bit as well. And so I sent off this document to him. And a few weeks later, he introduced me to a woman in Hanoi who had been an ambassador for Vietnam to many different countries. She had lost her father in the French War, and so she knew exactly what this loss meant, and she wanted to help. And so fast forward a couple weeks later, and the embassy in Washington, D.C. invited me to come down and present my idea to them. So I did. I went there a couple of days later.
And they embraced it?
20 minutes later, I will never forget this, the person that I met with was like, you know, our countries have come together, but our people have not. Mm-hmm. And we think your initiative could help that. We'd like to support you. So I walked out knowing this was actually going to happen, like I could actually connect with people. I was very excited.
So the purpose is to bring two sides together so you understand similar things that all of you universally have gone through, loss of loved ones.
Yeah, you know, what I learned getting sober is that when I connect with another alcoholic or another drug addict, I find a lot of commonality. I find a lot of experience. I find a lot of support, and I find a lot of humanity. And so I had that basis. I knew that. I also knew that, and Kim went before I did, but Kim went to Sons and Daughters in Touch meeting at the Wall. I think it was back in 2005, right, Kim?
Yep.
And she said, "You want to go?" And I was like, "No, I couldn't think of anything worse than sitting with a bunch of other people who had lost their dads." I thought, "No, that's going to be a cry fest for a whole weekend. I can't do that." But in 2010, I think it was 2010, I was ready. Maybe it was 2015. 2010, I was ready. 2015, I went back and I presented the idea of this trip to other sons and daughters on the American side. And five people were like, "Oh yeah, we want to go. We want to meet sons and daughters who lost fathers on the opposite side of the war." So it was really truly seeing the other side that we aimed to do. And of course, visit the sites where our dads died.
So you went with the other five, four daughters, two sons, and you had a documentary film crew with you too.
Yeah.
And they captured such extraordinary emotion on the part of both sides when you met. And so this was not just Margot looking or some of the other people trying to find their fathers, their locations where they went down or were lost, but it was much more about meeting people who on the other side endured awful things, lost loved ones.
Yeah, I screened everybody who wanted to go. I said, "It's as important that it's very important that you see the place where your dad died, but it's essential that you want to meet the other side. Are you with me on this?" And they all said, "Absolutely." Because they knew that would be a healing experience. It wasn't even something that they had much contemplated, but they knew that listening to the experience of other people who had lost their dads, in some cases, both of their parents in the war, and many, many other relatives, they knew that that experience, listening to those stories, would change them, and they were right.
You're in a room in the documentary with a number of other Vietnamese people, and one man at one point becomes very agitated. And I think you didn't quite know how you were going to react to him. And then he says something that was quite profound. He says, "In Vietnam, we have a saying that goes, forget the enemies, need more friends for all of us to live."
Yeah, that was an incredible experience. Mr. Siem is his name.
All right.
And we walked into the meeting and I instantly saw him. I noticed him right away because he was super agitated. He had a bunch of papers sort of on the desk and he wouldn't look us in the eye. And I thought, oh boy, here it is. You know, this was our last meeting in Vietnam and we hadn't encountered anyone who was angry. And I thought, well, you know, we're here. We're going to have to listen to this story. Even if he is angry, it's okay. We're just going to have to listen to it. So he started to talk and he has a rather remarkable story and Kim has some experience with him too. Kim, I'll let you share that. But his father was killed. And then I think it was 4 years later, he was in school and his job that morning was to walk around the school perimeter and make sure everything was safe. And as he was doing that, a bomber came in and bombed the school. And everybody in that classroom and in his school, everybody was killed, but three other students and another teacher, I think, survived. And so he grew up hating the Americans because they had killed not just his dad, but all his schoolmates and his teachers, his beloved people. He got into the military. He actually became a photojournalist during the war. Anyway, he was in that meeting. He was super agitated. He started talking about the dates that this bombing happened. And he said, I think 1967 or 68. And I was like, phew, okay, it's not 66. My dad didn't have anything to do with it. But as I just listened, you know, he said he was visibly shaken. He said, "I, similar to me, I don't want to feel this way anymore. I want to get this hate out of my system, and I want to, you know, come and meet you at this table. So I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here.
That must have been cathartic.
It was amazing. It's really hard to talk about it without crying because, I mean, that was just really beautiful. You know, you can see what it is when two people who have maybe the opposite side of experience of war, but very similar feelings of pain and loss, when you come together and you sit on the other side of this person and you form a relationship with them based on mutual understanding and its desire for peace, it's a transformative thing. It's really, really powerful. And Kim, I'd love you to talk about your experience too with Mr. Siem and the Two Sides Project as well.
Well, it's funny because Margo had asked me to sit in on that introduction of the Two Sides Project idea at that SDIT meeting in 2015. And I went just so she wouldn't be the only person in the room. And I thought everyone asked me if I was going to go. And I said, absolutely not. I think, no, I'm not ready. And no, it's not for me at all. And it's only through watching the documentary many, 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 many times that I felt like I was going to be able to go. And we went again in 2018. But I met some of the Vietnamese people who were in the documentary when they came to the screening in Washington, D.C. And I brought my family and went to go see it. And I didn't know how I was going to feel meeting the Vietnamese who were in the movie in person. And I brought, as I said, I brought our two sons, which are named after my father, and also our cousin who was killed in Vietnam. And this tiny, tiny, tiny Vietnamese woman who was in the movie runs up to my son, who's 6'4", and gives him the biggest hug. And I thought, what is wrong with me? These people have the same. They have children. They've had loss. We have so much more in common. And it just kind of broke down that wall, just seeing them in person. And you know, I spent some of the weekend with them. I know they had a lot of other official things they were doing with Margo. But when we went in 2018, I didn't even know if we would see these people again. I didn't know if they'd be in the meetings or we'd have an opportunity to see them. And we went to Mr. Siem's school, and I got off the bus, and there he was. And I started crying. I was so happy to see him, and I didn't even know I would feel that way. It's not that I missed him. I was just so happy to see him in his own country. And they were so kind to us and so welcoming. And he told us about how he had become a grandfather. And I was so happy to see them where they were. And it was incredible. I mean, that trip to Vietnam, I said, it's my first trip. I will definitely be back again with Margo and the Two Sides Project. But it was really, it was a gift. It was a gift that I was able to enjoy meeting people and actually being part of those conversations around the table that I had watched in the documentary so many times to prepare myself.
Yes. And Margo, you've been there 5 times, I think you told me, right?
I have. I just got back from our 5th trip. And, you know, so all told, about 20 Americans have met with more than 100 Vietnamese sons and daughters. This last trip, we met other family members. So people who had lost uncles, brothers, and of course, sons and daughters who had lost their dads. And then we saw some people that we've met before. So it was really nice to see sort of old friends and make new ones. And I continue to encounter some really remarkable stories, but also just experiences sitting across the table from sons and daughters. There was a woman, her name was Miss Soon, who I met this time for the first time in Ho Chi Minh City. And it's sometimes they're hesitant to come to the table too, to get to the meetings. And it's actually the veterans who fought against our dads who are the people who encourage them to come to these meetings. And so Ms. Soon was one of those slightly reluctant people. And she talked a lot about how, you know, her mother was 2 months pregnant with her when her father was killed. And so she grew up not knowing who he was and really, really missing him. But then quickly that turned to anger for her. She talked about how so angry she was because she was living in the country where Americans were at war with them. So she was experiencing this every day. She was so angry that she decided to go into the military and start fighting. And she was in the military from the time she was 14 to the time she was 60. And she said, that was the only way that I knew how to deal with that anger. And I could tell that she was still, she had some residual anger and stuff. And so after she, after we finished the meeting, I went to find her and she had left. And I was so sad because I wanted her to know, you know, I totally understand. I'm glad you came. May this be the start of, you know, you're being able to talk and about that and work through it.
Can I add something?
Sure.
To this? So one of the things that I thought was very interesting is we had one of these meetings with sons and daughters on the Vietnamese side. And two things stuck out to me from that meeting. First of all, they said, you know, you are doing your fathers a great honor to come and look for them. Mm-hmm. You know, to come to Vietnam and look for them. I thought that was remarkable. The second thing they said was, we feel sorry for you.
Yeah.
And I thought, what are you talking about? You have had the same loss. They said, our country supported us.
Yeah.
In the loss, in the you know, supporting the mothers and the children afterward, you didn't get that same kind of support. And I thought,
really? Oh. They said that?
They said, we feel sorry for you. And I was like, you're a third world country. How can you feel sorry for us?
And how did they know that? And it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
No one talked about it. I mean, you went through a good portion of your lives.
Yes.
I guess in some cases, people didn't even know what happened to your dad, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And we couldn't say what happened. There was no funeral. There's no gravestone to go to. And then we had people, how do you know your dad even died?
Oh. Yeah. I want to ask Margo, toward the end of the documentary, there's a scene with you where you're walking through a wooded area in Vietnam to presumably the site where your dad's plane went down. And you drop down and you read him a message. And you're very emotional, and it's an extremely powerful scene.
I always looked for you. I always thought I would run into you. I'd turn a corner and there you'd be, and I'd take you home. I don't know where you are physically, maybe you're here. Maybe you're nearby, but I have always felt you with me. As I stay sober each day, as I confront fears and do things that scare me, like being here right now, as I conceived and prepared for this trip, I find you in the best of me. I came to this area 6 years ago, and I didn't want to be here. I'm coming here today with a very different view and a very different feeling. It's more positive and joyful, but also so conflicted. I see the beauty of this place and its people, and I've seen the effects of the bombs, and I don't understand how someone who is so loving and kind and handsome and great could be at war with this place. But I have the perspective you never could have. I've seen things you didn't. I've connected with the people on a totally different level, and I'm sorry you could not, that at the time, the era, you could not do that. But I know that you've been here with me on this trip, and that all of our dads have been with us, that you are so proud of what we have done, and I am so proud of all of us, too.
What are you thinking when you're doing that?
Well, I had asked my mom and my sister if they had something that they wanted me to say for them. So I had those thoughts in my mind. I also was standing on ground and I wasn't really sure if that's where he was. You know, we have never had final confirmation. We're still looking. The DPAA is still looking. 57 years on for our father's site. And so I stood there. It was it was a crater. I could see that. I felt like, gosh, is this the place? But it was, you know, I just wasn't sure. So, oh, just a huge mass of feelings. You know, I just think being in the place where your father died, it, I think, takes enormous courage. It is a place I've thought about all my life, you know, and everybody who went with me. These are scenes that we've played out in our heads over and over and over again, and when you actually get to that place and you're there and you think about what happened there, it's very powerful. So I had a lot swirling in my mind, but I wanted to pass on the thoughts of my sister and my mom and myself. And I, you know, so it was challenging, but it was really beautiful too.
Is that the spot? Do you still believe that's the spot where he went down? Or is there possibly another location that you may have to go to?
I was in the wrong place.
You were.
I was in the wrong place. And, you know, my sister has led the charge with DPAA and my brother-in-law, Rich, too, investigating all of the records and sorting through all kinds of things. And I'll let her speak to where we think it is now and where we hope DPAA is going to investigate now. But
before you do that, DPAA is the defense. Tell us what that is.
The DPAA is the Department of Defense POW/MIA accounting agency. They used to be called JPEC. And what DPAA does is they work to recover service members who were missing from all wars. And so they've been active in Vietnam, active in Korea, active in parts of Europe for World War II. They are constantly searching for people. But today, there still are 1,577 people who are missing from the Vietnam War. And so their work is to find those people, among them our father.
And there are classifications that where they believe that remains may be recoverable and those that are not going to be possible. And I think your dad is in that category where they believe there could be recovery.
Right. So right now our dad is on active investigation. I think the worst category would be no further pursuit.
Yes.
Our dad is in active open investigation status right now. We believe they are finally in the correct location. It was many years in the making that we finally got to this area. They've been all over the Vietnam, which is pretty incredible considering it was a single pilot daylight crash over land.
Mm-hmm. So findable.
Like, right. You have to locate it. You have to investigate. They have to find proof that there was a crash there. In our case, they're looking for Vietnamese witnesses who can still recall a crash from 57 years ago. They're hoping to be able to find those witnesses. I think their time would be much better spent finding and analyzing aerial imagery, including reconnaissance images that were made over our dad's crash site in the 4 days post-crash. Apparently, nobody can find those images, but that would show a definite crater exactly in the correct location that needs to be investigated.
Well, the larger picture is two sides. So it's not just you continuing pursuit of finding any evidence of your father's remains.
Right.
But there's a larger purpose here, and that is never going to be lost on you.
Right. And, you know, we've met many, many people whose fathers are missing as well. There's something like 200,000 to 300,000 missing on the Vietnamese side still.
And that is something when I found out that number, I was horrified that here's a country that still can't find their own missing, and it's in their own country. I just thought, what a nightmare that, oh, your father was killed and he's in the next province, but we can't locate him. To me, it's hard enough having it, you know, be 12 hours away, but to have it in your own country with unexploded ordnance would just be, to me, a living nightmare.
I want to ask both of you what you've learned about yourselves during this journey. Many things, I suspect.
Yeah, so many. How to listen, how to empathize at a very sort of fundamental level. But I think I was also always searching for who am I? You know, I knew my mother and I knew the traits that my mother had, but I didn't know my dad. And so I didn't know which parts of me came from my father. And of course I had him being this perfect driver, you know, and pilot and wonderful, wonderful human being. And so, you know, but I was just really curious what parts of me were more like him. I had so little to go on, no memories, and only, you know, only things that our grandmother would share with us, like, you know, he liked the color yellow and really small things. I was looking for the big stuff. So I was always on this search, and anyone that I met who had known my father, I was always very curious, what was he like? And you know, they couldn't remember much. So I think simultaneously, I saw things in my mom I didn't like. And so, you know, I remember having a conversation with my mother, you know, I'm really confused. I don't know which parts of me are him and you. And, you know, and she said, oh, Marco, you're all you. Oh, you're great. All you. And I just loved that, because that was just a really lovely sort of way to say, just, you know,
it's okay.
It's cool.
Yeah,
you know,
it's okay.
You got maybe the best of both of us in you. So, so I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot. And I've also just learned a lot about people and humanity, which sounds so broad, but it's very specific for me. I feel connected to people now in a way that I've never felt before. I can always find something in common with people. And I think that's essential, especially these days when everything's so polarized and people are arguing about the smallest thing. I really try to find some kind of a commonality so that I can feel connected to the human race, you know.
Big picture stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I've learned. Kim, what do you think?
I've learned that I'm resilient and resourceful, and I'm very determined. And I think those traits have helped me in my life. I, too, have also wondered what my dad was like. I've connected with former pilots of his, people who grew up with him, just to understand what he was as a person rather than just the last day of his life, which I feel like sometimes in our search we're getting consumed with the details of a crash. So I've been trying to find out, as well as Margo, you know, what was he like? What kind of person was he? I've also heard that our oldest son is going to be 27 this year. And I've heard that's a really hard time when your children become older than your parent was.
Yeah, your dad was 27, wasn't he?
When he was 28? Yeah, he was 27. Margo and I have long passed 27, but now, you know, his grandchildren are coming up to those, that same age. And it's just kind of an interesting time to look forward and look back at the same time. But we've always known some things about our dad. You know, he was really big into sailing. He did the Chicago to Mackinac sailing race in the late 50s. And sailing is something I've always embraced and loved. And, you know, it feels like a connection with him over the time, even though we never went sailing. I know he liked to fish. I like to fish. My son likes to fish. So it's, you know, keeping those connections.
And you have these precious home videos long before there were cell phones. Mm. You're in the swimming pool. You're with dad.
Mm.
It's a neat picture that I'm sure has influenced you when you look at it over the years.
I love that clip. I always wondered what it was like to hug your dad.
We also have in Vietnam, they made a U.S. savings bond commercial with our dad. And it's the only movie that we have where it's like action voice in country. So the movies are amazing that we have, the home movies that we have, they're silent. We have tapes, a lot of tapes that my parents sent back and forth to each other. But that U.S. savings bond is pretty cool.
I've been asked to say a few words about government savings bonds. I buy them, and I'm glad I do, because I consider them to be an investment in both the future of my country and my own future. Having two children, I have my own bond program set up to put something aside for them in college.
Were these love messages sent back and forth? Are they recordings that your dad would send to your mom?
Yes. Okay. So I think what they would do is send the tape, and then the other person would record on the other side, and it would go back and forth. And Margo, didn't Mom get a lot of that transcribed?
She did, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I remember we had those tapes for a while. I could not listen to them. I just couldn't bear the thought
of listening. Yeah, to hear the voices too much.
Yeah. And I just, so I didn't listen to them for a long time, but I talked to my mom about them, and she said, these were, you know, they obviously were love letters to some extent, but more so she said, you'll probably find them kind of boring because he's telling me, like, don't forget to do this, and hey, if you have this issue, do this. And so it's a lot of household
chores on the home front
kind of thing. And there's beautiful messages to Kim and me, you know, from him. And he just sounds like such a sweet, sweet dad. I know that he loved kids. He did some work in Vietnam with kids when he could, off base, you know, taking care of kids or visiting schools or something like that. That's something that we had always heard. So, yeah.
What do you think, ladies, that your dad would think about your efforts now? Your pursuit of knowing who Dad was, finding remains, if at all possible, and then the Two Sides Project.
When I went to Vietnam on the first Two Sides Project trip, we were on an official government-sponsored trip. We were a delegation. This was actually the first time that there were formal meetings between sons and daughters, and so we were treated like royalty, basically. We got a private showing of Ho Chi Minh's body in the mausoleum. And I remember standing in front of this body thinking, oh my God, what would my father think of this, me standing in front of Ho Chi Minh? You know, I haven't thought about that so much as, you know, on the political side, I'm sure that, you know, he believed that communism was spreading and he was against that. And so he fought against that. I think on the human-to-human side, he would have been very supportive. And I think, you know, again, with decades of perspective behind him, maybe having survived a war, I think he would have been very open to it. I know that my mother was, and my mother was, our mom was so supportive of the Two Sides Project, as were her friends. So, but Kim, on the search side, what do you think?
When Margo went to Vietnam the first time, and it turns out that it wasn't the right place exactly, my mom had said at that point, you know, just the fact that you're in the country, like, that's so important. I'm a very detail-oriented person, and I want to know the exact crash location. That's what's been driving me, and that's the thing that's been the most frustrating is finding out that DPA doesn't actually know where the crash location is. I think they're very, very close right now, and a lot of that is based on work that our family has done, as well as work with a Healing Through History organization to find mission coordinates and target coordinates and interview pilots about what the terrain was like, find out operation specific things. So that's been my driving for probably the last 15 plus years. I have an interesting little quote that somebody wrote about basically saying that if the end of your story is not known, if everyone gives up trying to find out what happened to you, there is a sense that you did not matter. I want to live in a society where everybody matters. And everybody, our side, the opposite side, everybody who's missing still matters to people. The people that they left behind will never forget them. And I have such a strong feeling that our government shouldn't forget them either. I mean, the American people know that there's so many people still missing over in Vietnam. And it's important that we keep searching for our father, recover any remains, try and get him back to show that he still matters. I mean, he'll always matter to us. And I want to do everything I can to get him found and to bring him back. I want that done in my lifetime. I do not want to pass this mission on to my children.
Okay.
It's time. It's been, this year will be 58 years. We tried to get it done by the time, you know, before our mother died 2 years ago, and we didn't get it done. And it's very, very important to me and my family that we get him back.
I want to thank both of you very much for spending a little time with me so we get a better understanding of your lives and the agonies that you've gone through trying to learn more about your dad and the efforts you've made to help other people understand loss and how to deal with it. It's pretty extraordinary stuff.
Thanks, Paul.
You're welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much, Paul. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Again, thanks to Kim and Margot. And thanks, too, to the creators of the Two Sides Project documentary, director Anthony Ostrico and writer-editor Nora Kubach, for their outstanding work. You can see that award-winning documentary simply by going online for The Two Sides Project. It is powerful. We'd invite you to share this podcast and listen for more stories as Honor Flight Chicago begins another flight season. The impact Honor Flight Chicago has on the lives of our veterans and their families is made possible by the generosity of our donors. To support our mission, to find our veteran application, to volunteer, or simply for more information, please visit us at honorflightchicago.org.